idiot. Welcome to broken capitalism. When I say that, I'm referring to the course that I'm giving, Broken Capitalism. I'm not welcoming you to the broken capitalism as something that exists. I don't welcome that. I'm not even sure I welcome my lectures, but one's supposed to say that. Okay, so what we're going to be doing in this course is going through some measures that various people have proposed, like minimum wage laws, tariffs, and other things. And we'll be discussing whether these are good ideas. Not to spoil the suspense, I'm afraid, but it's going to turn out that they're not good ideas. I hope that doesn't surprise anybody. But before I go into the main subject of the lecture, I just want to explain for those of you who aren't familiar with Mises Academy, if there are any who haven't taken courses before from Mises Academy or courses from me, the way the course works is that I'll lecture for about an hour or so, and then the rest of the time is discussions and questions, but you can also, while I'm lecturing, you can type remarks into the chat section, but I usually respond to them, but not always. So it's not guaranteed if you put something in the chat that I'm going to answer right away, but you can do that if you want. Then also, for those who take the courses, want to take the course for credit, there is a weekly quiz. This is strictly optional. I give the quiz. It's 10 multiple choice questions. I try to make these exams easy. I'm not trying to trick you. It's just you might like it. It's a good way of seeing whether you understand some of the basic concepts in the lecture. I'm glad I don't have to take the quizzes. It's bad enough writing them, but having to take them would be much worse. Okay, let's see. That didn't work. Okay, now to start with the course, we can distinguish two different ways that an economy can be organized. By economy, I mean something like the economic system in a nation, like the economy of the United States or the economy of China, a large-scale way of organizing an economy. And these two ways are capitalism and socialism. Now, socialism is a system which production is centrally controlled. Instead of people just going out into the market and deciding, say, they'd like to start a business of their own or they'll try to get a job from some existing company, the government plans the whole economy, so you don't get to decide to start a business on your own. The government is telling you what to do and what kind of businesses there are. The government is running things. So we could imagine, say, the whole economy was run something like the Postal Service in the U.S. Everything's run by the government. Now, one thing, this will be very important later in the lecture, when we say socialism, the government is controlling everything, this doesn't have to be formal ownership by the government. That's to say, in a socialist system, it doesn't have to be the case. You might be a bit surprised by this. Suppose somebody says, who owns the steel factory in a socialist state? You would think, well, in a socialist state, just a person couldn't say, I do, because it would be the whole government that's owning everything. But you could have a form of socialism where you have people would be private owners, but the government would be controlling everything. As I say, we'll see later that this actually was the case historically. There have been systems like that where somebody could say, I'm the owner, say, of a certain factory, but it's still socialism because the government is telling this owner what he has to do. Now, the other system is the free market. Now, Travis, that sounds like National Socialism. Well, as you'll see, Travis, you're exactly right. That's one of the what we're going to be talking about a little later in the lecture. I have that's one of the main examples, probably the main one, of this kind of socialism, where it's not that the government claims to own everything, but it's just it controls whatever the ostensible owners are doing. So the government is really in charge, even if the legal system says they're private owners. Now, the other system is the free market. This is a system we all like in the Mises Institute. It's based on social cooperation through the free market. In the basic idea of the free market is people, it's very difficult for people or impossible for people to produce everything we want just by ourselves. Say, I couldn't grow my own food or build my own house. I'd be dead if I tried to do that. But what I can try to do, instead of trying to do everything myself, I can make exchanges with other people. Well, where they'll give me something that I want in return for my doing something for them. So in the free market, the basis of the system is voluntary exchanges, and this permits the division of labor, and we can have a very productive economy. So we have the two systems are socialism, where you have central control of the economy, and the free market, which is based on social cooperation and voluntary exchange. Now, a contention Mises has, it's perhaps at first sight surprising, he said, these are the only two systems. You either have the free market, capital, you have capitalism or socialism. There isn't any other choice. Again, remember, we're talking about developed economies on a large scale, like economies of the United States or China. We don't have any other choices. Now, I should just kind of as a parenthesis say that Mises, particularly in his book Socialism, which came out in Germany in 1922, mentions another system called syndicalism, which is one where groups of workers are running the economy, kind of not responding to the market. But this system is really not a major rival. It doesn't work at all. People really have ignored it. So for our purposes, the only choice we have is capitalism or socialism. Now, an objection to this comes up. Well, the objection, remember, is to the view that these are the only two systems, that we either have capitalism or socialism. What happens if the government owns some industries, such as railroads? Say, if you look at England in the 20th century, the railroads were run by the government at some points. They're not now, but they were. So, and of course, in most countries, the government owns the post office or sometimes the educational system. So if the government owns some things in the economy, like railroads or the education system, but other things are run by the market, why isn't this an intermediate system? You see, Mises said there aren't any intermediate systems between capitalism and socialism. It's just you have a choice between capitalism and socialism, but it appears we have an intermediate system, namely one where the government owns a few things like railroads, but not other things. So why doesn't this count as an intermediate system? And Mises said, no, that isn't a good objection, because if the government takes over production within a market economy, we still have a market economy. And why is that? So what Mises is saying is, look, suppose the government takes over railroads, running, owning the railroads, that doesn't convert the economy into a socialist system. Because why not? Because, well, this nationalized industry must still sell its product on the market. Say you have a government-owned railroad, then they have to compete on the market for the consumer's money. Say you have to compete against other types of transportation. Say you airplanes or cars or trucks, you're still able to compete with the nationalist industry, and the nationalist industry still sells its product to consumers. It doesn't compel people to buy from it. You don't have to go on the railroad. They just have to make their products available just like other industries. So they're competing for money from the consumers. So they're still subject to the basic principles of free market economics. We don't have a situation where the capitalist or free market system has been replaced by a socialist system. It isn't that because these industries are owned by the government, then you have really the government is planning the economy or telling people what to do. It isn't even telling consumers of these industries the government owns what they have to do. It isn't saying to people, you have to travel on the railroad or you have to buy electricity from the government. So that these industries are still, that owned by the government, are still competing on the market. Now, it is true, though, if you have a nationalized industry, it doesn't operate exactly the same as an industry would that was privately owned. In particular, a government industry doesn't face the same pressures to meet consumer demand as private businesses would. So if you work say you're a bureaucrat, a government employee running a government business, you're not in the same position as an entrepreneur who's running a business on the market. And a major difference is that suppose your business isn't doing very well. Let's stick with this example, the railroads. Suppose the railroads aren't doing very well, they're losing money, or say it's the post office usually loses money. So if it were a private business, then if it keeps losing money, it's going to collapse and it'll fail, and then funds will flow elsewhere into the economy. But a government service isn't like that, because if the government is losing money, it can just pay the debt through taxes, so it can just force people through taxes to pay its costs, and it can keep in business even though on the market it would probably have to go out of business. And there's a further point. In a private business, the owners are risking their own money. They can make a lot of money if they are successful. They'll make profit if they can satisfy the consumers. But if they don't, then they're going to lose their own money. And if you have a business, you're going to be operating a different way if you're just playing at the market and if you're really risking your own money. Supposing you come up with some very risky plan, if you were a private business owner, you might think, well, that's too risky. I don't want to do that, because then if this fails, I'm really going to be out a lot of money. But a bureaucrat could say, well, why not? I'm going to do this. I'm going to get paid. Invest doesn't work, so I'm going to go right ahead and do things. And this particular point, you can't play at the market, actually came in very famously in one controversy. But as we'll see almost immediately, Mises had an argument that a socialist system, let's say one where the government is planning the whole economy, runs everything, can't work. So one of the replies to Mises, given, say, by the Polish socialist economist Oskar Lange, said, well, we can have within a socialist system some kind of markets also. They're not private, we run market, but we can allow, say, these industries owned by the government to compete with each other. So we can have kind of a quasi-market, not a real market, but we can have something like a market, and in that way we can solve the problems that Mises has set out for socialism. And I'll be explaining very shortly what those problems are. But basically they said, look, Mises, you think the market is necessary to solve certain problems, but we can, under socialism, we can imitate the market. So we don't need the market. And I see there's a question from Helen. Economic development attempts to stimulate local economy with government money. Can you comment on this? Well, I think we'll be getting to economic development a little later. So that'll come up. That's a very good question, but we'll be dealing with that one a little later. Essentially, what happens is if you use, you have to get the money from somewhere, and it'll be, if you have a government running development, it'll be taking away money that the private businesses would be using in other things. And we have good reason to think that the private businesses will do a better job than the government. But what we're concerned with now is this reply that the socialists like Oskar Lange say, well, look, we can imitate the market. So whatever problems you think socialism would have, you say only the market can solve. Look, we can imitate the market, so we can still have socialism. So what Mises said in reply says, well, you can't play at the market. It's not a genuine market unless people are actually risking their own money. Now, since we mentioned this argument that Mises raised against socialism, I think it's a very important argument, so I want to go into that a little bit so we can understand. It's a basic thing, basic theme in Austrian economics, so we understand this argument. So what Mises said in his book, Socialism, which as I said came out in 1922, was that a fully socialist economy can't work. And what he meant by a fully socialist economy was one that where the socialist economy wouldn't be able to have any use of prices by the capitalist, other capitalist economies. So, say, the Soviet economy, Soviet Russia, throughout the time it existed, wouldn't qualify as fully socialist because the Soviets could make use of capitalist pricing. So what Mises said was, well, in any complex modern economy, there are a great many production goods. The production good or capital good is one that's used to help produce other goods. Say, like steel is a production good. It's used to produce all sorts of other goods. So we have production goods. Now, suppose you have a production good, let's stick with this case of steel. It can be used to make various things. You can use steel to make skyscrapers, bridges. You can use steel, as some people do. Say in Russia, they use steel to make in dental work. So you'd have steel in your to fill your teeth. You could use steel for all sorts of things. So how do you decide what's the best way to use steel in these different uses, given that it has alternative uses that are technically possible? Well, by the best way, I mean this. Suppose you have a list of all the consumer goods you want. Which is the best way to use steel? Of course, the same question would come up for all any other production good. Which is the best way for you to use this good so you'll be able to get as many of your consumer wants satisfied and get them satisfied to the greatest extent possible? But what is the most efficient way to use production goods? And Mises said, in order to decide this question, you want to allocate resources efficiently, you have to be able to calculate in money. You could say, well, if you use it this way, you'll make more money than you would if you use it some other way. And you need market prices in order to calculate in money. So see, here's the argument against socialism. You can't have market prices under socialism. You don't, because of course, by definition, you don't have a real private market under socialism. You don't have market prices, then you don't have calculation in money. And then if you don't have calculation in money, you don't know how to use production goods in a way that'll best satisfy your list of consumer goods. So the economy won't work. You will have no way of calculating. Now, where the point comes up, this calculation argument comes up for our person. Remember, we're talking now mainly about the system where the government owns just a few industries, and we said that's still a market system. So you might think, well, why am I talking about the socialist calculation argument if we've still got a market system? We've just got a free market, but the government, say, owns the railroads. So why are we talking about the calculation argument? That's an argument that is the plot that shows that full-scale socialism won't work. But this is a very important point to take note of. The calculation argument doesn't apply only to full socialism. Introducing socialist elements in a market economy creates what Murray Rothbard called islands of calculational chaos. I like that phrase. It has a nice ring to it. What do you mean by that? Is that, remember, if you don't have market pricing, then you're not able to calculate. So if you have the government owning an industry, it will interfere with the full operation of the price system. And you won't have the complete economic calculation that you would have in a fully free market system. And if you read Man, Economy, and State, I just got back last week from the Rothbard Graduate School, the Mises Institute. We had a whole week of lectures on Man, Economy, and State. And this is a very important theme in that book, that the calculation argument kicks in before you get to full socialism. As soon as you start nationalizing industries, you're going to have problems because you'll get interfere with the economic calculation of the free market. Now, what we've talked about so far is, as I said, this is not an intermediate system. We've talked about so far is a state of affairs where we have a free market, but the government owns certain industries. So once it owns these industries, the industries then those still have to compete against other privately owned industries for the consumer's money. And we mentioned some ways which is these industries have advantages over private business. Say the government can pay for losses with taxes in ways that are different, but they're still competing, in spite of these differences, they're still competing with the private industries for money. But what I want to talk about now is a different sort of deviation from the completely free economy. The government can interfere with the free market in a different way from taking over production of goods and services. And this is what we call interventionism. And here, the government can pass laws that restrict market transactions in certain ways. So the government, say, isn't taking over particular businesses, but it's telling the businesses, you have to do things in a certain way. For example, price control would be an example of this, where price control is saying the price won't be set by the free market, won't be set by bargaining with among the producers and consumers. At least it won't be set by them completely as they wish. They'll be subject to certain limitations. An example would be a minimum wage law, which would say wages can't go below a certain amount. So even if people in the free market wanted voluntarily to make a contract where someone would work for less than the minimum wage law wouldn't allow that. Rent control is another example. But say a landlord can't charge more than a fixed amount for the apartment that he's renting. Tariffs are another example. This said, if you sell a good to another country, you're going to have to pay an extra amount that'll be added to your cost. That adds to your cost that the people who are native to the country don't have to pay. So if there's a tariff and you're a foreigner who's trying to sell something, you'll have to pay extra money. So this again is interfering with the voluntary bargains people would make. Imagine you're someone living in China and you'd like to sell something to the U.S. to someone in the U.S. So under the free market, you could make an exchange with that person on whatever terms you wanted. But if there's a tariff, you can't do that. You have to pay an extra fee if you want to sell your product in the U.S. Now, here Mises makes a point we've already seen him make as regards these cases where you have nationalized industry. Remember, you're saying they don't create some third kind of system between capitalism and socialism. He says they're only, for all practical purposes, leaving syndicalism aside. There are only two basic economic systems, capitalism and socialism. So now Travis asked corporatism. Well, that actually would be, depending on how it was interpreted, that would be actually a kind of syndicalism. But as I say, that was never really been put into practice on an extended scale. So these interventions where we have the government is trying to tells people in the economy they have to do things in a certain way, they don't create an intermediate system between capitalism and socialism either. They just hamper the workings of the free market economy. So you don't have a case where these interventions create some other system. It's still capitalism, but it's capitalism that the government is interfering with. Now, Mises' criticism of interventionism follows a characteristic pattern of argument. And it's very important that we pay attention to this pattern, because this is really a very important contribution he made, I think, both to economics and also to political philosophy, this particular style or pattern of argument. So what the pattern is that we first take the goal that the interventionist wants. Say the interventionist said, we want to have minimum wages, say, because we want workers to earn more money. So then, after that, we show that the intervention won't achieve this. So the minimum wage laws, as we'll see later, don't result in workers earning more money. At least some workers might, but some other workers will suffer for it. So the intervention isn't going to be successful given the goal that the interventionist wants. Now, what's so significant about that is this is a value-free method of criticism. What do I mean by this? Well, Mises is not just saying something like, I like the free market, so this measure you're proposing is no good because it goes against my preferences. Or he's not saying, as some people would, some people would say, well, look, it's just objectively morally wrong to interfere with the free market. It's just immoral to do this, so you shouldn't do this. In each of those cases where you can imagine saying something like, interventionism goes against my personal preferences, or interventionism is morally wrong, you would be introducing values into the argument. Now, it might be, particularly if you think there are objectively true values, that might not be a bad thing to do, but that isn't the way Mises is going. What he said is he can show that these interventions, when he says these interventionist measures don't work, he's not making his argument dependent on particular values that he or anyone else holds. He's just saying it's a strictly factual judgment that these measures won't work. So see, then it's very important that you get the significance of this. He's saying, again, it isn't dependent on your moral likes or dislikes or your political views whether this argument is valid. If you're a socialist or interventionist, you should still accept this argument because the argument isn't dependent on any preferences or values that you have. It's a strictly objective argument that, given a particular goal, the method won't achieve. It'd be just like saying, if you want to hammer a nail in, it's not a good way to do it to use your fist instead of a hammer. That wouldn't be making a value judgment, just saying this isn't a good way, in the sense it won't work, you won't get what you want if you do things that way. So let's take an example of this type of argument. Suppose that the government thinks that the price of milk is too high. So they say, why is it too high? Because at the high price, poor people will find it hard to buy milk. They just don't have enough money to buy milk. So wouldn't it be better if we lower the price and then the poor will be able to buy milk? So the government decides to impose a maximum price on milk to make it easier for poor people to buy milk. So they say, okay, now the price is lower. These poor people, at least they have something so they can now buy milk. So again, now what Mises is going to argue is not that something like, well, the government shouldn't do that because then you're violating the rights of the milk producers because they have the right to decide whatever prices, to charge whatever prices they want. I think that that would be perfectly true to argue that the government shouldn't do that because it violates rights. But if you argue that way, you're introducing a particular ethical system, and Mises' argument doesn't depend on doing that. He's going to say, I can show what's wrong with price control without any special, without any appeal to particular values that people might or might not hold. Now, what will happen at the lower price, more milk will be demanded by consumers. And why is that? Well, when the price of something is lower, then you're going to demand more, at least not demand less, because if you pay less for something, you have more money left that you can buy other things with. You don't have to give up as much of other goods to get milk. You can have more by, when the price goes down, you're able to get milk without having to give up other things that you want to the same extent as if the price were higher. So you're going to want more milk. But suppliers won't supply more because if the price goes down, they're going to be making less. If they could have made more by lowering the price, if they could make more money by lowering the price, you would need the government to get them to lower the price. They would have done it already. So the suppliers, before we put in the price control, were selling at a price that would make the most money for them. So if you lower the price, they're not going to supply more because they'd be losing if they did that. And another thing will happen is that marginal sellers, I'd say those who were making the least return, say businesses that are milk sellers that are just kind of scraping by, they'll leave the business because they were just getting by on the old price. They were barely making enough to keep going. And now the government is compelling them to sell at a price that they'll have less profit, so they're going to get out of the business. Now, I see a question from Jack here. It's an interesting one. Does this mean subsidies wouldn't have the problem of price control because they wouldn't be losing any money? If you subsidize, gave them, he says, you're giving the, you're thinking a case where you give people money to buy more milk. Yes, that's actually been proposed by people. That subsidies would create other problems. But if you give people money and tell them, say, give the poor people money directly, then that doesn't interfere with the free market price in the way that the price control will. Now, here's one point to note. If Mises is talking about marginal sellers, that say people are making the least return, he's assuming here that not everyone in the business, he's assuming that not everybody in the business will earn the same return, because if everybody earned the same return, then it wouldn't make sense to talk about marginal sellers. And why is he justified in thinking that? Well, remember, the free market, the businesses are trying to keep adjusting to consumer preferences, but consumer preferences are always changing. So you don't have a complete adjustment at any one time. The preferences are always changing. The businesses have to adjust to them. Now, if the preferences didn't keep changing, then everybody would in business would earn the same return, because say somebody earned more than other business people would come over there and lower the return, or if they earned less, people would leave that line of work until the rate of return went up. So if preferences stopped, if we were in, stayed the same, if we were in equilibrium, everybody would earn the same return. But that isn't the case in the actual world economy. So we have this situation where you can have marginal sellers, and price control makes them leave the business because they were barely getting along before, and now they've really had it. So what is the result of price control? Well, as a result of the government's action, less milk is available. We've seen that the marginal sellers are driven out, and there'll be no incentive for suppliers to expand the availability of milk because they won't be getting as much profit as they were before. But this was not what the price control was supposed to do. Remember, the purpose of the price control was to make more milk available so that poor people could buy milk. And it doesn't. It reduces the amount of milk available. So you see what's involved here is Mises saying, look, it's supposed to increase the supply of milk, but it in fact reduces it. So it isn't achieving what it's supposed to do. But this criticism he's making doesn't involve any value judgments that he's making, not saying price control is bad because it violates people's rights, or you can show that it's inconsistent with argumentation ethics, or it's not universally preferable behavior, whatever ethical system you want to talk about. He's just saying it doesn't work on its own terms, so he's not making a value judgment of his own. Now, we can see exactly the same process if we have rent control, where rent control is you have the government saying rents can't go above a certain price. And what is the aim of rent control? Well, it's supposed to be to make more housing available for the poor. The idea is that under the free market, a lot of poor people can't afford to buy, to rent their own apartments, so we're going to lower rents so then they'll be able to pay for their apartment. But again, what happens at the rent control price? More housing is demanded that is available. The price goes down. Demand, quantity demanded increases, and the supply doesn't increase. So what's going to happen with rent control? Well, landlords who can't make money will withdraw housing from the market, and if they have housing that's still on the market, then they won't repair it because it'll be too costly for them to do so. Sometimes rent control can be quite extreme. Mises mentions that in Vienna after World War I, where rent control was in effect, he said something like the rent on an apartment was equivalent to about two trips on a railroad, so you wouldn't be getting very much for the rent at all. But even if you have less extreme rent control, it's still going to result in a not as much housing available as there was before. So again, the result is that the aims of rent control aren't achieved because rent control is supposed to make more housing available for the poor, but it doesn't have that result. So again, we have this value-free criticism of an interventionist measure. Now let's look at one other case of the same pattern. I think you should be getting by now this pattern where Mises is drawing attention to, where the interventionist measure won't achieve the goals that the advocates of it profess to want by it. They say, we want this, but the measure won't give them that. Now, minimum wage laws are supposed to raise wages for workers, and they're not supposed to harm the worker. They're supposed to help the worker by giving him higher wages. A minimum wage is a price floor. And when we're talking about rent control and price control, say we're talking about price of milk, that those are price ceilings. That says that the price can't go above a certain amount. Say if the rent is limited to $500 a month for an apartment, you can't charge more than $500. Now, minimum wage is different. Minimum wage is the price floor. I say you can't go below this price. So instead of, say, it isn't saying here's a certain amount, you can't pay people more wages than this. This is saying you have to pay them at least this much. So what's going to happen if you have minimum wage? Well, more workers will want to work at the minimum wage than employers are willing to hire. And how do we know that? Well, if that weren't true, there wouldn't be any need for the minimum wage because the employers would have already be offering that. So if you have a minimum wage, there'll be people who want to work at that wage that employers are not willing to hire at that wage. And why wouldn't they? Well, what's going to determine what wage rate an employer gives you? Say, imagine you apply for a job at McDonald's. What's going to determine how much money you get is it'll be determined by how much what you're producing is worth to the employer. If it's not profitable for the employer to hire you at a particular wage, if the work you're doing is not worth as much to him as the minimum wage is, then the employer is not going to hire you, or if you're working for him already, you'll be fired. So again, we have the same pattern we saw before. The minimum wage will result in workers not being employed, namely the ones who aren't producing enough for it to be profitable to employ them at that wage. If they got less than the minimum wage, then they could in certain cases get a job, because then the employer would find that the amount he's giving them is worth it to him. So again, we have a case where the intervention fails to achieve the goal. The goal was to help these workers. I said, well, we don't want these workers to get very low wages, so we'll just pass minimum wage, then they can get higher wages. Isn't that a great thing? But they forgot or didn't take account that if workers aren't worth that much to the employer, then he won't hire them. You can have minimum wage law said, if you want to hire somebody, then you can't pay them below a certain amount, but it doesn't say you have to hire the person. So the employer can say, okay, if I have to pay minimum wage to hire this person, I'm just not going to hire them at all. And that isn't very useful to the worker who, if he wants to work, would have taken the job at a lower wage. It doesn't help him much to say, oh, you're going to get a higher wage if you work, if you're not working. Remind me of it. Is it actually happened? Is that a story where someone asked, was going to buy a certain, I think he was buying some fruit in a store, and he said they're selling this fruit, I think it was apples, and they're selling it for 10 cents cheaper across the street. And then the owner said, well, why don't you buy it over there? And he said, well, they're out across the street. And then the fellow said, well, when we're out, we charge 10 cents cheaper too. So again, it doesn't help you if you're going to make a higher wage if you're not working. I see I had a typo in the next slide. It more should be tariffs make products more costly for consumers. And again, this is another case, tariffs, why they put people have tariffs? Well, it's supposed to be benefiting the nation. They say, well, we don't want to, we want to have our own steel industry. We don't want to lose our car. We don't want to lose out, say, if we don't lose out to the Japanese. We want to have American cars. So this is to the benefit of Americans if we have American cars. But they don't take account that the tariffs will make the products more costly for consumers. You could have bought, without the tariffs, you could have bought a car more cheaply from the foreign business that was selling it. So this is going to hurt consumers. Again, it's not making a value judgment that you shouldn't support your own nation, or you should promote the consumers over the national industry. It isn't making such a value judgment. The criticism is that the people who support the tariffs say this will help consumers, and it doesn't because it makes products more costly for them. Another problem with tariffs is by decreasing competition, they enable cartels to be formed. A cartel is an arrangement of large firms in an industry that sets prices. These are very difficult to keep going on a free market for a long time. But if you have tariffs, that makes it much easier for such cartels to be formed. Now, what happens when intervention fails? Suppose, say, we have the case of the milk that I gave. The government said we're going to have a price control on milk so that more milk will be available to the poor, so it doesn't work. So what happens then? Well, the government may respond with more intervention. For example, those milk sellers say they can't make a profit. So then the government said, well, okay, you're not making a profit because we've lowered your selling price, but whether you make a profit is dependent on whether your revenue is greater than your cost. So we can lower your cost by imposing price controls on the suppliers of milk into the store. So you're going to say to these people, well, okay, you're complaining because of these price controls we have, but we'll help you out by imposing price controls that benefit you. As you might expect, these interventions don't work for the same reasons we've already covered. They just will reduce supply, and there'll be greater demand than supply at the artificially lower price. So the new interventions don't work either. And I see Drew says, couldn't the milk suppliers also circumvent the price controls with other fees? Yes, they could do that. There are various ways people can try to get around price control. You're quite right. So what happens if these new interventions fail. Well, the government might respond with still more interventions. But if it keeps that up, then you'll very soon have total government control of the economy, because you'll have the government be setting prices for everything. It starts off setting prices for a few things and it'll keep expanding the interventions. So it'll be setting prices for everything. And this isn't just a theoretical possibility. That sort of thing took place in Germany during World War I. This is the so-called Hindenburg Plan, which the German government was really setting prices on nearly everything in the German economy. It also happened in Britain in both World War I and World War II, that the government was setting prices for everything because one intervention didn't work and it led to more intervention. Soon the government was controlling the economy. Now Mises makes a very interesting historical observation. During World War II, you remember the prime minister was Winston Churchill. And after near the end of the war in 1945, Churchill was lost office, and he was replaced as prime minister by the Labour Party leader, Clement Attlee. So after the war, there was a period of austerity and socialism. So most people say that socialism came in with the Labour government. Remember, the Labour Party is also known as the Socialist Party. So people say, well, Churchill was a defender of the free market, but then he lost out and they had socialism in Britain after the war. But Churchill said, Mises said, no, Churchill, by this system of price control, was the one who really brought socialism to Britain. So it wasn't the Labour government, was the person who was claimed to be supporting capitalism, who really brought socialism to Britain in the 1940s. I guess mentioning passing, Churchill commented about Clement Attlee. He said, he's a very modest man, and he has a great deal to be modest about. Okay, now, perhaps the case where we see this government control the economy at its height, where you don't have government ownership, was the Nazi regime, let's say the system that was in power in Germany in the period 1933 to 1945. And in the Nazi economy, prices and wages were set by government directives. So you had people who, remember I talked about this a little at the beginning of the lecture, you have a system where they're private owners. Somebody could say, I'm the owner of this factory. But you really, even though you were the owner, you had to follow what the government said completely. You were in effect made into a government bureaucrat because the government would be telling you what to do. And if we bear this in mind, we can see what's wrong with the Marxist interpretation of the Nazis. The Marxists say under the Nazis it was really big business that was in control, but actually it was the government that was running things because they were telling the businesses what prices to do, and they were to charge, and they were controlling everything that happened. Now, the last thing I want to mention is one thing in the chapter may have disturbed some people, but I think we can take this in a way, we have to be very careful to see what Mises is driving at. He says, Mises mentions the slogan, that government is best which governs least. And he says he doesn't accept that because he says the government should fulfill its proper functions, that's say defense and protection. So if a government isn't defending or protecting people, that would be doing less than a government that did that. So he says, well, it's false, the government best, which is government least. Now, if you're sympathetic to anarchism, free market anarchism, you're going to say, oh, well, isn't this terrible? Mises is endorsing government. But I think what Mises is saying can actually be taken in a way consistent with anarchism, although this isn't the way Mises was going this way, at least in this passage. There are other things in his work which are not secession that are more sympathetic to anarchism. But the key point, I think, to bear in mind in this is that Mises is saying that force, the use of force, should be restricted to defense and protection. And force can't be used justifiably for other things in the free market, like telling people what prices to set. And this would be true also under anarcho-capitalism, that you would be using force only for defense and protection, because the private protection agencies, defense agencies, wouldn't be telling people what prices to set. They would just be defending people, protecting people, settling lawsuits, that sort of thing. And what I think is the point here is that Mises is saying force should be restricted to these functions. So it's not really important for what he's saying whether defense or protection has to be provided by a monopoly agency. The key here is that he thinks that force should be restricted to defense and protection. Okay, so I think that'll be enough lecturing for today, and we can now go into the questions. Let's see, did I miss anything people had in the chat? I don't see anything. I see there's something about tariffs. Okay, so do we have any questions, objections, comments, jokes? I like jokes, but I could get into big trouble for telling the wrong one, so I'd better not do that. Oh, thank you, Jack. Jack likes my lecture. Thank you, Jack. You're a good person, I can tell. Now, Drew said, how would removing the minimum wage laws to combat unemployment work in today's market? Well, an example would be many teenagers who were unable to get a job because of minimum wages would find that they're able to get a job if you didn't have minimum wage. And one thing I think is interesting in this connection, you see a lot of programs, some institutions and programs have what they call internship programs, where people, young people, can work for the firm and they get some experience working for a particular firm or institution, but they don't get paid anything. Now, I think it's very likely if we didn't have minimum wage laws, interns would be paid. And why is that? Well, if their services are worth something to the employer, then people would offer them something. If they didn't, they would be bid away from, those interns would be bid away by other firms who were offering them money. So I would think one effect of abolishing minimum wage laws, we would see fewer internship programs. But the specific details on, I mean, one would have to do a study of the economy to show how minimum wage laws would, any minimum wage laws would help particular groups of workers, that's more a question that would just, you'd have to do an investigation of that to answer that fully. But we can see the general principle that would be operating. Now, Travis said, what do you think about us abandoning the word libertarian? Because not only the left anarchists around the world are reclaiming the word liberal, it's true, pure classical sense. The word libertarian has become so contaminated with right versus left version, which I will take no part of. In Europe, the word liberal remains pure in its classical sense, whereas libertarian means anarcho-communist. If we begin calling ourselves liberals, will join our true liberal brothers and sisters around the world. There may be something to what you say, but you do have to remember also the word liberal in the United States doesn't mean classical liberal to most people. It would mean more like a socialist or interventionist. So the problem I see with your line of argument is you're saying, well, we shouldn't use the term libertarian because some people mean by that kind of a left anarchist view, but we should use the term classical liberal, even though, I mean, we should use the term liberal, even though there are people who mean by liberal not something that we accept either. So it's not clear why would the fact that some people don't use the word libertarian to mean what we mean by it be a reason to abandon libertarianism, whereas the fact that some people use the word liberal to mean what we don't mean by it not be a reason to avoid using that term. So you see, to go on with it, you say they are social democrats, progressives, and we should start calling them that, reclaim liberal. I think that's a very good suggestion, but then couldn't the person who likes libertarian say we should start just saying we're the true libertarians rather than the leftist libertarians? So, yeah, I'm not rejecting your proposal, I'm just trying to find out why you think there's this asymmetry. It seems like you're saying, well, people are using one term, so we shouldn't use that term. But on the other hand, we should use this term, even though there are also people who use the term that you favor in a way you don't approve of. There seems to be different standards there. I mean, that's not a contradiction, but I'm just wondering why you take it that way. Now, Drew says, I think it's funny how Mises says that inflation is primitive on page 41. Now, I not remember what does he say about it? I don't have the text in front of me. Jack says, who would win in a fist fight, Mises or Rothbard? Well, probably neither one, they're both dead. Let's see, Danny has something. Oh, this is on dealing with some point about tariffs. Yes, well, I think the question was, wasn't it something like, if you don't have tariffs, then what if the war breaks out and you can't have you need some raw material, then you don't have it. Well, I mean, if that happens, you can always try to shift to production of the raw material when you need it. But I mean, it doesn't follow that you should store up all sorts of materials on the assumption that you're, just because there's a possibility you might need them at some time or other. And if people wanted to do that, they could simply buy the materials that they needed and store them up. It isn't clear why they'd have to do it by imposing tariffs. And then, let's see, Drew mentioned that the Emperor Diocletian used in the 3rd century. Yes, he says there that, you know, they, instead of now inflation is the government simply prints more money or has the banking system expand credit. But there what they did, they would debase the coinage. They would reduce the value of the coinage by mixing in a less valuable metal. The Emperor Diocletian was one who very much tried to impose price controls, and they didn't work, even though he had very drastic methods of enforcement, such as execution, but they didn't work. So Travis says, are we then right-wing libertarians? I would say no. Right-wingers see national socialism, mercantilism, protectionists, and libertarians first used by anarcho-communists. So I was just thinking of returning the word libertarian to its original owner. We reclaim our original name as well as, which is true, liberalism. Well, I mean, that's certainly, I'm not saying that's a bad proposal. I mean, certainly one thing you could do. Oh, remember, there were individualist anarchists in the 19th century, like Benjamin Tucker, who called themselves libertarians, I think. So I don't think, I see. So, I mean, you seem like you're putting a lot of stress on what is the original meaning, use of a term is determining what should determine our contemporary uses. I'm not sure I'd want to do that, but I don't have any objection if you want to do that. I mean, it's certainly, if people want to do it that way, that's the way you suggest, that would be fine. Why not? Now, Leslie says primitive inflation is only debasing coins, not using sophisticated measures such as fractional reserve banking, etc. I see. Yes. So that's, I see. Okay, so tariffs, okay. Well, at one point, it's nothing on tariffs. If there is a war, I mean, that doesn't generally eliminate international trade. Unless you're dependent on a particular material in which you're getting it from some nation that won't trade with you, it isn't clear why that would be a problem. And remember, also, goods are, they're usually substitutes for goods that you can't get. So it's not a case, if you don't get a certain good during a war, you're absolutely finished. In most cases, you're usually able to substitute something else. But in general, people say, oh, we've got to stockpile materials through tariffs, and just using that as an excuse to support tariffs. Okay, Travis is hoping to take back the word liberal. Yes, I mean, that was something classical. It does have, as you point out, in Europe, it does have a meaning more closer to classical liberal. A beautiful office. So this is the place this is my apartment. I'm living here. Now, Travis said, did Roderick Long hate capitalism? Well, again, you have to be very careful on the terms there. What he means by capitalism is not the free market. He means something like the system where the government is in partnership with business. I don't agree with all his claims about the contemporary American economy, but when he says he just doesn't like the word capitalism because he associates that with what they call crony capitalism or government-business partnership. He prefers to talk what he calls the freed market, F-R-E-E-D, rather than free market. I suggested to my friend Sheldon Richmond, you know, the left libertarians, not meaning the communist ones, but the ones who are free market libertarians, a particular group that includes Roderick and Sheldon, want to talk about the freed market rather than the free market. So I suggested comrades, how about calling it the fried market? And he thought, he laughed at that. But it's one good thing about Sheldon, he laughs at my jokes. Now, Travis doesn't like C4SS. Now, Drew says, in my first lesson, my college economics, they claim that free market doesn't work because Say's law doesn't hold. And then says, and there aren't different buyers and sellers of government interventions needed. What me to say to this argument? Well, if you look in Planning for Freedom, Mises has a brief chapter called Lord Keynes and Say's Law. Your college book isn't right. Say's Law, which says that the demand for a commodity is ultimately another commodity. So it's that your demand for goods really consists of goods that you're supplying. And that holds in that. That's true. Keynes had in mind a situation where there's kind of a failure in investment. Businesses just aren't investing enough. And then he says you won't have you'll have a case where people just are withholding money and not either spending it or investing it. They're just kind of taking money out of the economy. You're going to have a collapse. But I don't think he was right in what he said. If you look at Mises and Murray Rothbard, a very good discussion of Keynes in Man, Economy, and State. But I think if you start with this essay, Lord Keynes and Say's Law by Mises, the one I mentioned, I think Cam has already a link to that. I think that would give you a very good account of what's wrong with this idea that Say's Law doesn't hold. Jack says, how would national defense work in an anarchist society? Well, we have a question first. Would we, in an anarchist society, how large would the units be? I mean, if you had the anarchist societies were extensive enough to be like a modern nation, you would just have the defense would be provided privately, or you might have perhaps more likely to be something like where a group of anarchist societies would get together and form some kind of common defense agency. I mean, you're, Travis is right. You wouldn't have a nation. I mean, there wouldn't, but you would still have competing agencies. And they wouldn't, I mean, one of the suggestions, they'd be insurance companies. That isn't required by the concept of private protection agencies. They'd be insurance companies. I mean, that's one suggestion that many people have given. Though. Now, Charlie said, I would love to see George Reisman and Robert Long battle each other over economics. I think we know already who would win. Oh yes, well, they don't get along on this, on economics. I remember, of course, Roderick is very fond of this writer, Kevin Carson, and George Reisman thinks he's, I thought he made a very good case, and that really Carson doesn't know what he's talking about. So they wouldn't get along at all on this subject. Oh, Travis, I've never met Carson. I haven't really studied his books. I didn't have a very high opinion of him from the little I've seen of him. But Roderick does take him quite seriously. I'm not sure why. Drew said, what examples of price ceiling exist in the market today? Well, one example would be their usury laws, say, in certain states, their limits on how much interest you can charge to people. We have rent control in many areas. Sometimes, say in emergencies, say there'll be laws passed saying that you gasoline suppliers can't just keep raising the price the way they want, even though that will help adjust supply demand. There would be laws prohibiting it. Danny says Sheldon Richmond also like cars. Yes, I think all the ones in this C4SS group like Carson, but I really haven't kept up with them. I know Gary Chartier, who's an anarchist philosopher I know quite well, likes Carson also, but I've never really seen what the fuss is supposed to be about. I think Travis apparently has some acquaintance with Mr. Carson. Hasn't made him very favorable to him. Now, Cam says, I remember Carson was going to prove Hopper wrong. I'm still waiting. Well, it'll probably be a long wait. What was he going to argue against, Hans? You know, when you mentioned, he had a list. When you mentioned, Danny points out recency or value and price may be closer to Carson than Roderick. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Reisman has some kind of some elements of a cost of production theory. You try and combine David Ricardo with Mises. It's kind of an unstable mixture. But Reisman thinks that Kevin Carson is a communist, and he wrote a review. Roderick, when he was editor of Journal of Libertarian Studies, had a symposium on one of Carson's books, and Reisman, I think, had the most negative article about it. as Ken says, he has had a list. Remind me of, you know, in the Mikado, when the Lord High Executioner says, I have a little list. Now, Travis says, I just got back from an IHS summer seminar. We discussed Rothbard. James Buchanan refutes Rothbard's anarchy by saying that Rothbard presumes that property rights will be naturally settled for a legal system protections agency established, because this will lead to bonds before society can get established. Have you said this critique by Buchanan? How would you respond to it? Rothbard, remember we talked about value freedom. Rothbard is assuming in the society wants that people accept a libertarian legal code. See, Buchanan is somewhat of a moral nihilist. He thinks that when he talks about limits in his system, the property rights are simply ones that would be established by people on the market, taking account of what they might do to one another. He's kind of a Hobbesian view. So he's not starting from a moral standpoint. He's just saying, what rights would emerge as a result of people trying to make arrangements, each person acting in his or her self-interest. But that isn't the starting point that Rothbard is working from. Rothbard is starting from an explicit theory of rights. So it isn't, I don't think Buchanan can be taken to refute Rothbard. He's just giving a very different view. I think I have in one of the publications, I think it's Review of Austrian Economics, I have a little bit on Buchanan, where I deal, but I mean, he's not arguing from a moral standpoint at all. I mean, it's a pure Hobbesian position. Anthony de Jesse is another one who takes what I call a moral nihilist, so I don't think that's the correct way to do things. I mean, Buchanan was a very good economist. He was a very interesting person. I'll say, since I'm a great name dropper, he was a reader of my Mises Review. I didn't know him. I just spoke to him a very few times on the telephone, but he would sometimes give me suggestions of books to review. So, I mean, I think highly of him, but I don't think he was right in his criticism of Rothbard. Gordon Tullock was a very interesting person. Also, I knew him better than I knew Buchanan. Jack says, what is a popular view on abortion for a libertarian? Is the evictionist view gaining popularity? Well, of course, that's a controversial subject. I mean, people have different, I'm going to make it rather trite remark, people have different views about it. I don't know whether the evictionist view, that's one Walter Block has, is gaining popularity. I mean, it's one of the options. I mean, I think that, I tend to, sort of the controversial view that that would just isn't really fully settled by libertarian theory, because it depends on various views you have about the standing of the baby before birth. You might look in, there's a debate in libertarian form between Murray Rothbard and James Sadowski on abortion. I thought that was interesting. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so we'll see you, I hope, next week, either on Monday or Thursday, but not Tuesday. I hope I find out which day it is before the next lecture, and you'll be able to take the first quiz also. So thanks to everybody for coming to the lecture.